The most valuable commodity on Earth today is data. How we make it, use it, move it, and protect it. My name's David McCall. Join me today for the QTS experience. 3, 2, 1, Charlie Silver on the QTS experience. Charlie, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Where are you joining us from?
I am in sunny Southern California, La Jolla, part of San Diego.
Oh, yeah. I know La Jolla well. When I was a kid, I'm still into dirt bike racing, but down there in La Jolla and Carlsbad and all the way down almost to Glamis, that whole area produced probably, with the exception of David Bailey, five of the greatest motocross racers, certainly of the 80s of all time. I remember it well. They used to whip our butts. Have you ever been dirt bike racing?
Well, you know, when I was a teenager, I did have a dirt bike, but it's been a long time. But I enjoyed it when I was 16, 17 years old.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And California had a million places to ride. They're all, you know, condos or houses or parking lots now, or you can't ride, but it's a good time. A lot of fun. I miss those times. But hey, look, the reason why I wanted to come on the show is I've had so many conversations in the last number of months about everything from really around this idea of what Web 3.0, which to me begs the question, well, what's Web 1.0 and what's Web 2.0? And we wanted to find somebody who knows that business well and understands that conversation. And so, of course, we reached out and asked you to join us. I thought maybe for our audience's benefit, you could help us understand kind of what, when we say, before we get to what's Web 3.0, what do we mean by Web 1.0, Web 2.0, et cetera, and just kind of help us on the timeline and the journey of what does that mean?
Yeah, and I was there. I started a company called Real Age, which was really a Web 1 and 2.0 company that was very successful. Most people probably know my partner and spokesperson, Dr. Mehmet Oz. Mm. Dr. Oz, you know, is on TV.
Yeah.
He was my partner, and we had built a company called Real Age, which is a health media company that if you entered in all this data about yourself, we told you what your real age was or your biological age and how you can grow younger. And it was a huge success. We had 60 million users. We were on the Oprah show all the time. And to understand how the migration of the web 1, 2, 3, think about data. It's all about data and how it's used. And data is by far the most valuable commodity in the modern era. So if you think of the progression of the web, think about how data has been used. Mm. Well, Web 1.0 was AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy. Do you remember those companies?
Yeah.
But think of that as Web 1.0. Okay. The first pathway onto the World Wide Web were these companies. Mm. Web 2.0 really started with the Netscape browser, right? Mm. Netscape made the whole web available to everybody. You didn't need to sign up for AOL or Prodigy or CompuServe. You can log on and surf the web through the Netscape browser. Mm. And that opened up all of these business models on the web, you know, retail and media and, you know, all the portals, Yahoo, Excite, you know, Ask Jeeves. I don't know if you remember these.
I forgot.
These companies.
Yeah.
But again, if you think about data centricity, then Google was obviously the huge player in Facebook, followed soon after. It's all about data. Mm. These guys were able to build all of these products that are valuable to users, right? Search, social media, Gmail, email. But it serves one purpose, to collect data. Mm. That's why Google's worth $1.8 trillion. Facebook is worth $1 trillion. And get your mind about what $1 trillion is.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't really have a concept of what $1 trillion is. And if you don't mind, I could share something that
Yeah, please
sort of gives the impact. If you had $1 million, everybody knows what $1 million is. And if you spent it every single day since Jesus was born, over 2,000 years, you wouldn't even be at 1 trillion.
Wow.
If you spent $1 million day for 2,000 years, you're not even close to a trillion.
Wow. That's a significant number. You know, why did I think that it was either Apple or Amazon was the first $1 trillion market cap, but whether it's Google or Facebook or whoever, we have for the first time in history, $1 trillion market cap companies. And they're, to your point, they're all around data. You know, 50 years ago, it was oil or meatpacking or Eastman Kodak or whatever. And now, you know, a diverse group of economic models, or not economic models, but, you know, products and services. And today it's around cloud or e-commerce or social media or platforms and all around data. Yeah.
Right. No. So Web 2.0, think of the massive platforms collecting massive amounts of data about all of us. Mm-hmm. Now, Web 3.0, stay with the data-centric theme. Mm-hmm. Individuals now will be in control of their data. That's really the essence of Web 3, mm-hmm. where 2 was the platforms having all this stuff to basically gather all this data without your explicit consent. Mm-hmm. Web 3 is going to be, well, if you want to use my data, you got to ask me permission, mm-hmm. and you got to reward me. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the foundation of Web 3, where individuals are in control of their data. This decentralization effect from the massive centralized control of data, mm-hmm. to individuals being in control.
So when you think about that, like, so for example, I'm all in your description, the Web 2.0 model, my email that I use, my web browser that I use, the devices in my home, et cetera, because they're easy and free, I use them. And I recognize that I'm giving up elements of privacy. I recognize that I'm giving up information about myself, but because it's so easy, I don't worry that much about it, I guess, or think that much about it. Why, if we move, does everybody have to adopt Web 3.0, or, you know, is it going to break things, or how do you imagine as we transition? Because to go from Web 1.0 to 2.0, it's pretty easy, pretty natural. It was, you know, organizations were showing up and say, hey, you want free email? Hey, you want free search? Hey, not only that, while you're searching, look at this. I see you're searching for tires. Did you know that in your market, these four companies are, you know, have tires for sale at this, and they're rated like that? And I saw that, and I saw that as a service. Now there's a lot of conversation around, you know, not just privacy, but conversations around, you know what, I was just having a verbal conversation. I didn't even have an internet search. And then this showed up in the next time I logged on, and people are starting to scratch their heads like, should I be worried about that? So if we move from a 2.0 to a 3.0, by we, I just mean consumers, one, do you think we're obligated to do that? And two, does it start breaking stuff, or do you think it's much ado about nothing? I'm the things that I'm posing really aren't things to worry about.
Well, it will happen slowly at first, like all technology changes. They happen slowly and then all at once. It happens over time, and then it seems like, oh, it just happened overnight.
Right.
But no, 2.0, the Google, Facebook model will continue. But there are things that are forcing changes. Mm. Regulation is a big one. Mm-hmm. You've heard of GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation.
Certainly.
In Europe. There's something that passed in California, which is now going to be enforced. It's called the California Consumer Privacy Act. Mm. It basically says if you're going to use an individual's data, they have to explicitly give consent. Mm. And giving consent does not mean I accept cookies. That was the backdoor way of gathering all your browsing data, all your search data by accepting cookies. Well, cookies taste good, but people don't even know what the hell it means.
Right.
Now, platforms, publishers, e-commerce providers, have to explicitly say, will you share your data in an explicit way? Apple has been out in front of this. If you're an app store application in the Apple App Store, which there are millions of them, Apple now, in it's a requirement, you have to explicitly ask permission to use data. 90% people say no. They say no. But even though they've been saying yes for years about accepting cookies, when you ask them, will you share your data in that explicit way, people say no.
But when they do that, what do they what do they lose? Do they still get access to the app?
Well, they do, but they're not going to be as good, obviously. They're not going to be as personalized. So what Permission is building, we've created a cryptocurrency called Ask.
Now, Permission is your company.
Right.
Right.
And we've created this cryptocurrency, ASK, Ask, for the explicit purpose of asking permission to use data. If you're going to use my data, it's obviously worth something. Pay me for it. And that's what we're all about, is in the hundreds of different contexts where advertisers speak to consumers, we're providing all of the infrastructure so an advertiser can ask permission and reward somebody to opt in and give consent to use their data.
And so in this model, when they opt in, and I know there's other organizations that are, I can't remember the name, it's not important for this conversation, but there was a friend of mine who's in the IoT space was telling me there are organizations, which really kind of intrigued me, where you can buy their router, set it up in your house, and it provides free, quote unquote, free connectivity to users in the area. And depending upon the usage of your router, they'll pay you in cryptocurrency. That's not Web 3.0. It's Web 2.0. But he said that this is a trend going forward that you're going to see people, one, taking ownership of their data, whether it's in this case or it's their healthcare or whatever, one, to use their data to monetize it and get paid for it, two, to control it. If I don't want to use that healthcare provider anymore, I can pull my data back and it all comes with me and I can take it to the next organization or whatever. And I asked him, what do you think this means then for those that don't want to do it or there's always unintended consequences. How does doing this break what we're used to doing now before it gets repaired and moves forward? And, he speculated a number of things, but he wasn't sure exactly.
I'm not exactly sure either, but, the bottom line is individuals will be in control. I mean, you're in control of your bank account, accounts and other vendors you do business with, right? I mean, think of all the vendors you deal with, people, hundreds,
right?
Imagine a world where you'll share your data with certain vendors, but not with others. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's going to be about. I mean, the vendors that provide great value to you, you want to create a deeper relationship, And you're willing to share that, but with other vendors that you don't know or trust, you're not going to share it with until you've built trust. And that's if you look, our logo is the handshake, right? It's all about trust is built when you exchange value, when two parties exchange value, and that's how you build trust. And so Web3 is going to be a new world where data is not going to be exploited. Mm-hmm. It's going to be exchanged for value in a relationship, long-term relationship building kind of way. And to me, it's all positive. I mean, it's, I see these technology changes just enhancing people's experience and allowing them to earn from what they own. Their data has got real value. I mean, people don't understand lead generation. Do you know what that term refers to?
Tell me.
It's a big part of the web.
Right.
You hear about these insurance companies. Okay, no, best one, credit score. Get your free credit score, right? All right, sign up, get your free credit report and learn how to repair it. That's what's called lead generation. Experian gets these millions of people to sign up. They then sell the data to the credit card companies.
Right.
Oh, look at Dave. He's got a credit score of 750. And then you start getting, you know, offers to sign up for American Express, Visa, whatever. Right. You know, those are lead generation companies. They're just collecting data.
Right.
Life insurance, SelectQuote, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Just lead generation. You know, they get your data. Oh, you're looking for $1 million life insurance policy. Then they sell it to all the life insurance companies. They get 600-700 hours a lead.
Mm-hmm.
You get nothing.
Right.
So lead generation is a huge part of the web. You know, all the hotel companies, travel companies, it's just lead generation. Finding out people that are looking for something and they aggregate those leads and then sell them to the other companies. So that, you deserve a cut. Right. People should get a cut of that. Right. A big cut.
Now, how do you, when you say people should take ownership of their data, I get that you say, you know, you've got the tool to opt in or opt out, but what's the technology behind it to make sure that you can opt out and they can't exploit you?
A lot of it has to do with the business practices of the people involved, you know, like anything. I mean, if somebody is dishonest, they're dishonest. I mean, and, you know, but that comes out real quickly. But most, we're enabling, and it's any advertiser anywhere in the world to run ads on the open web and offer ASK for people to opt in and share their data.
So go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, so this, you know, we're one of a few companies that are really leading the way in this context to enable. There's so many problems in digital advertising. People have no idea. Like 50% of the traffic is bots and organized crime, creating click farms.
What?
You know, oh my goodness. Yes.
What do you
I mean, it's remarkable that people don't know this. Click fraud is the number two business in organized crime globally.
What's click fraud?
$80 billion business. What?
What's click fraud?
Okay. I'm Procter & Gamble. I run a $1 million campaign on Google for Pampers diapers. Okay.
Yep.
Procter & Gamble pays Google for clicks. And every time someone clicks on a Procter & Gamble ad and a Google distributed ad, Google gets paid, you know, 50 cents or whatever.
Right.
Okay. So organized crime, they set up websites for young moms, you know, just put a bunch of content in there. Just a few articles about being a new mom or something.
Right.
And they have algorithms, bots, essentially, just clicking on the ad all day long. Boom, 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 boom. As a publisher, they get a check from Google. That's essentially Procter & Gamble's money. But Google's the distributor. $80 billion in click fraud around the world. $80 billion industry. When Procter & Gamble runs their ad, they know 50% of their money is going to hackers and criminals. That's the dirty little secret behind. And Google has no incentive to shut it down. They profit from it.
But how much control would they have over it? How would they stop it? Or anybody? I mean, any Google, whoever. I mean, how do you – Facebook, I'm sure, you know, any of the big providers, if their platforms – forget incentive. How would they do it?
Well, that's what part of Web 3.0. When Nike runs an ad on the permission platform and it offers somebody 200 ASK to opt in and share their data, they then have to go through a process of opening up a wallet, becoming verified. A bot can't do it.
Right.
You know, you got to do 2FA, maybe even show your driver's license,
right.
You know, and it's real verified users. And the people who spend big money on digital advertising know half their money goes to fraud.
Yeah.
To organized crime.
Well, it's interesting. The NSA said, it's been a decade now, I can't believe it, but they said a while ago, and it's still true, that the next 10 years will be the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of human beings. And what they were referring to is this umbrella of cybercrime. And essentially, that's what we're talking about here. So it could be malware, it could be ransomware, it could be click fraud, it could be all of these different things where individuals or organizations are losing money through scams or paying money to things that are illegit or whatever, what this combination of things, it's going to be this huge, huge transfer of wealth. You would think organizations would be more incented to help thwart it, to help interfere with it.
Well, cybersecurity is a massive, massive industry, hundreds of billions. I mean, it's an arms race. Mm-hmm. You know, hackers figure out stuff. People figure out how to defend against it. You know, it's no different than in the military world. You know, new weapons, defense systems, new weapons to counter those defense systems. You know, it's just the spiral.
Yeah.
It's the same thing in hackers, you know, in cybersecurity. And it's an arms race. But, you know, new models are coming. Web3 is a new model where people will be verified, share their data, and, you know, advertisers will get a better ROI off of dealing with real people who are incentivized to be marketed to.
What's the role? A lot of my listeners aren't familiar with blockchain. What's the role of blockchain in the back in as part of this?
Well, right now, blockchains are great tools for transactions. Mm-hmm. It's all about immutable, meaning you can never change it. Once a record is created, it can't ever be erased or deleted. And transparency. That's what a blockchain is better than a traditional database. And it's distributed. Mm-hmm. So blockchain is a perfect vehicle for issuing cryptocurrency. Mm. Right now, that is the use case for blockchains.
Right.
It's not a good vehicle for storing, you know, terabytes and exabytes of data. They're not good vehicles. They're good vehicles for transactions.
Right.
And recording transactions. And they're really good for that. Mm-hmm. Right now, the best thing about blockchains is the ability to issue crypto to a specific wallet address. And that transaction is immutable. And that's why when people talk about criminals using crypto, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because if I'm a criminal, I'd much rather have a suitcase full of dollars of cash that are untrackable rather than having to give somebody a bunch of Bitcoin addresses or any other crypto address, which is totally trackable to a web address. And, you know,
it's interesting that you lose in a scenario like this, you lose anonymity. I mean, they want anonymity. People that for whatever reason, you know, they're not necessarily criminal, but I want to, they imagine, I don't think they have it, but a lot of users imagine that they have some anonymity depending upon the browser or the circumstance. They want to go search for something that maybe people in their household or their office or whatever wouldn't approve of them searching. It's not necessarily illegal, but for whatever reason, they want to remain anonymous. I have to remind them, you know, your router's being tracked. They know where that they know where that thing's coming from, that search string or whatever. Even if you use a VPN in many cases, it's not hard to get back to who asked what, or at least what household asked what.
Well, look, there's a lot of needs for privacy. I mean, 40 to 50% of internet traffic is pornography. It is.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Half the internet is pornography. And, you know, most normal people, you know, they check out porn here and there. I mean, what's the big deal?
Right.
But, you know, there are browsers like Brave that, you know, collect no data.
Right.
You know, so you want to use that if you're going to porn sites, right. You know, and you don't want any tracking of that. So, but the reality is data about you, whether you browse privately or not, is out there. Mm-hmm. Your motor vehicle records, your utility records, I mean, your utility bills, your magazine subscriptions, your, I mean, just about everything you can imagine is data is packaged, sold, and resold.
Yeah.
And there's the only way to really be private is to be off the grid.
Right.
You got a cable bill. Cable companies sell your data all day long. Everybody does. I mean, your data is sold and resold and repackaged. And the only way to really be private is to be off the grid.
So in your, when you look at whether it's permission.io, your organization or others, do you see them also not just extending in like a marketplace where, you know, I want to go to Macy's and they've got to ask specific permission from me and I give it to them, but do you see it happening with my local utility companies? Do you see it happening with my, you know, with everybody that I do online business with?
Yep. I think every data, you know, like credit scores, credit card companies, you know, that data sold over and over and over again. Your bank account information sold over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's not private. Your voting records. The state of California makes, you know, like $100 million a year selling voting rolls. I mean, it's crazy. And people have no idea. All your motor vehicle records are sold and repackaged and resold by the state. But that's going to change.
Right.
Laws and regulations are happening, and it's all changing.
Now, so, what are people's appetite? So I get it. You know, you present to somebody, look, here's why it benefits you. It's benefiting someone. Obviously, data has value or things wouldn't be free. They charge you for them. So they're finding value. They're finding more value in using your quote unquote free data than charging you for the use of their services. And so our discussion here is, well, you should take ownership of that. So there's going to be technology that allows you to take ownership of that, number one. And number two, as you interact, we're not saying don't interact with these vendors, interact with them, but you have then this, you have this discussion. I'm going to give you this valuable information, my data, and I'm going to have defined how you can use it, and you're going to reward me. And the reward in this circumstance is cryptocurrency. Most people that I know that are not technologists are wary of, when I say cryptocurrency to them, it doesn't even matter what the currency is. They have no sophistication around really the big idea and the opportunities around crypto. They don't know the differences. It's like saying soft Coca-Cola instead of soft drink. They all sort of land under this lump name. How, as you guys have been coming to the marketplace with this idea, what's been, do people embrace the idea of getting paid in crypto or being rewarded in crypto? How does that work? What's the market reaction?
Well, okay. So it's really the cohort 18 to 34, which is the demographic most advertisers want to reach because, you know, once you start buying something, you buy it for life, you know?
Right.
I mean, you want to get to people young. So in the 18 to 34 cohort in the US, 20% own crypto of some sort. 20% in the US own crypto, and it's very aspirational for the rest. I mean, now once you start getting over 45, 50, you know, people, it's the same thing in the internet. You know, in 1995, when you talk to a 50-year-old about the internet, they're like, whatever, you know. But 10 years later, I mean, it becomes part of everybody's life. Right. So again, technology changes slowly and then all at once.
Right.
You know? So my guess, 5 years, and I'll say 5 years from now, anybody who's active in the financial world, if they have a credit card or a bank account,
right,
will own some crypto.
So do you think it'll be as common as like you open my wallet, I might have an American Express, a Discover, a Visa, whatever. I have three or four different credit card company or credit cards that I use for different things, different reward programs or whatever. Do you think crypto will be that same way? I might have some Bitcoin, I might have some ASK, I might have some whoever, or
yeah, Visa and MasterCard are huge in the crypto space. I can right now, today, most cryptos that are legit can issue a Visa with that, you know, like as a debit card with X amount of crypto on it that people can use as a debit card. And Visa and MasterCard are all behind it. So is PayPal, all the payment companies, Square. Crypto's the future. It is the future for all of these companies. And as a, in fact, the big banks are now custodians of crypto. If you have, whatever, $1,000 of Bitcoin, you can deposit it at Wells Fargo.
What's the benefit of that? Why would I do that?
No benefit. I mean, why do you deposit your dollars in a bank? Just so it's a little more secure, you know, and insured, yeah. You know.
Well, the reason why I deposit originally, the original reason why I put my dollars in the bank were two reasons. One, they have a safe unlike what I could have in my house. So in the world of crypto, they would have a server or some kind of IT infrastructure that's more secure than I could do, would be the, sort of the analogy I would guess. And two, if you took it from the bank, depending upon the bank or what era we're talking about, it's insured to a certain amount of money. And so I don't have to have my life savings in my house that can be robbed or burnt down or whatever. I'm not a crypto expert, but it seems to, I mean, at least the early days of when we say crypto in early days, we meant Bitcoin. There's a number of legitimate crypto out there today. But if somebody got your currency, you know, it was their currency. They were, you know, it wasn't yours anymore. At least that's how I understand it. So I'm wondering if people are, you know, how are they making part of the adoption of crypto is I understand it and you know, I feel safe in using it. No different than when we, you know, paper came in, right? We used to all use coins or bartered, and when paper came in and we had to start paying payroll in England in the 1600s or whatever it was, people were like, what the heck is, you know, paper? I don't trust this. So how do you imagine people can react to embracing the idea of crypto as normative?
Well, again, it's a slow process and it's happening. I mean, it's really, really, really happening. You know, there are certain states in the U.S. that will accept Bitcoin. You can pay your taxes in Arizona, Wyoming, and Florida in Bitcoin.
Really?
Did you know that?
No, yeah. I had no idea.
In Ohio, too.
Wow.
So it's happening, again, slowly and then all at once. And there are some major hurdles. A lot of it has to do with federal regulation.
Right.
And there's a lot of ambiguity around crypto at the federal level about how it's taxed, how it should be accounted for, capital gains, you know, fees on transactions. There's just a whole host of issues that the DC regulators have not addressed and that they need to be addressed.
Right.
And when that happens, bar the door, because every institution, everybody, you know, it's just going to be. It's going to become mainstream, in my view, very quickly once regulation gets deep clarity.
Now, how today would somebody know if one crypto or the other is legit?
It's no different than, you know, I hate to use the analogy of a stock because crypto is not a stock.
Right.
But, you know, if you buy a stock in a company, you know, how do you know the companies? You got to do your research. You got to, or rely on experts, you know, one or the other.
Well, I'm not trading stocks for, like, you know, I'm using currency, either electronic currency or physical currency to, you know, buy. I'm getting paid in it. I'm trading it for products and services. And, I put my faith in whoever it is that's issuing the currency. In our case, the United States of America. And some people, especially people that are more sophisticated with money, may, you know, depending upon how the world's going, put their, you know, move their dollars around to invest in other countries' currency. But it's really that country or that federal government or whatever you're talking about. That's what you're putting your faith in. Whereas with crypto, it's not a government institution behind it now. It is the ledger and the organization that's behind it, at least as I understand it. And as it's an evolving marketplace, there are stories out there of less than maybe it's like the early days of the stock market. I don't know. It's a parallel, I think. It's not a direct analogy, but people are trying to figure out, is this organization legit? Is this something that I should participate in, or should I choose that one over there? Who's gonna stick around? And because it's currency, I think it's different than choosing Beta or VHS.
Well, no, you're exactly right. And it's exactly right. I mean, the organization that issues the crypto, you have to do your research and understand what's behind it. But I'll tell you this. I mean, there are bad actors. There is no question there have been bad actors in crypto. But I'll tell you, there are, dozens and dozens of very, super compliant, legitimate crypto companies like us that bend over backwards to be transparent and comply with every possible law imaginable and be totally transparent. And when you think about fiat currency, government issued currency, there's no transparency. Zero. You have no idea how much is really being printed and how much is in supply. And the supply really is the biggest driver of the value. The Fed sits around the table and decides, oh, we're going to print another trillion this month. Based on what? There's no set of rules. There's no transparency. It's a bunch of people deciding, for whatever arbitrary reason. And by the way, most of them are political reasons.
Sure.
There's no fundamental economic reasons. It's all driven by politics. And that's true around the world. So fiat currencies, which are government-issued currencies, have always failed. Always. There's never been one that survived more than 100 years or so. The dollar is up against, and what's happening with the dollar is it's lost 98% of its value to gold in the last 50 years since Nixon broke the connection of the dollar and gold in 1971. The dollar's lost 98% of its value in 50 years. So what's it going to take to lose the next 98%? Rapidly in decline.
Why would crypto be any different, though? Why would it not?
Well, let's take Bitcoin as the best example,
sure.
The first and most valuable crypto.
Right.
Finite supply. Only 23 million Bitcoin ever created. Forever. History.
Right.
That's it. 23 million. Never can create more than that.
Right.
So every Bitcoin that's ever been created is trackable. And, it's totally decentralized, meaning no one entity can make a decision about its governance. And it's an incredible invention.
So how does that benefit people? I guess my question is, whatever the political reasons are for various, for currency, fiat currency, as you described it, and I'm trying to swim in safe water since this is a corporate podcast, but whatever that reason is, it seemed to me that I guess I'm curious from you, what is it that cryptocurrency brings to the table if, to get legitimate, it needs to be taxed and regulated by governmental agencies for at least wider adoption? Those seem like diametrically opposed situations. You want, I'm going to use cryptocurrency as opposed to regular currency or government currency, fiat currency. And yet I need the fiat to bless the crypto. How does that work?
Well, I'm not sure you need the fiat to bless the crypto. And I think they both can exist in the same world. I don't think one necessitates pushing out of the other.
Right.
They both can coexist. Bitcoin's been a wonderful store of value. I mean, it's trading at close to 50,000 today. when I first got involved in 4 years ago, it was $900, and now it's $50,000.
And people thought you were crazy for getting involved at $900 when 5 years before or whatever, it was, you know, $6 or something.
Yeah, or 6 cents.
6 cents.
You know, it took 10,000 Bitcoin to buy a pizza.
Right.
You know, anyway, so, and Ethereum is an incredible store of value. I'd like to think of ASK, our currency, will take on that, you know, as a real store of value. Mm-hmm. So, you know, before paper currency, you know, or before the Federal Reserve in 1913, one of the things that made the United States grow into the biggest economy in the world was a real free market in money. Mm. In the 19th century, before the Federal Reserve in 1913, Wells Fargo would issue its own notes. Union Bank would issue its notes. You know, J.P. Morgan would issue their notes. You wanted to sell your business or a house. Oh, I don't want Wells Fargo notes. I want J.P. Morgan notes. I like those better. Hmm. It was a real free market in currency. And the U.S. only printed gold as the U.S. currency and silver. Mm-hmm. So it's not like there hasn't been a free market in money. That right. Money is a product, and you decide which one you want to transact with.
Right. You think crypto brings us back to the benefits of the free market and money?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it does. And it allows money to compete for trust and transparency and compete against fiat. Mm-hmm. You know, you're selling your house. Tom Brady's taking Bitcoin. You know,
yeah,
he wants to be paid in Bitcoin. So do a lot of athletes and musicians. I mean, you know, it's happening. It's becoming part of the culture.
You get me excited. I thought I had a formed opinion, but I need to get more informed.
Crypto. Okay. So thinking about Web 3.0.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many dimensions to this. Think about Web 2.0 disrupted retail in a huge way, right?
Right.
Again, slowly at first, and then all of a sudden.
Right.
Media, television networks, newspaper companies. I mean, newspaper companies, Warren Buffett used to talk about owning a local newspaper was the best investment because it was had a local monopoly.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? You can't give away these papers anyway.
Right.
You know, they used to be worth billions or hundreds of millions. Now they're worth nothing.
Right.
You know? So the internet totally disrupted media, totally disrupted retail. Web 3.0, money and banking is going to be disrupted like you can't even imagine.
Well, I'm trying to imagine because I, you know, in the early days, not all the disruption's been great disruption, right? Before, one of the cool things about that local paper was they're peer-reviewed. You knew who was writing the story. There was a reputation of trust there. If so-and-so said it, there was real consequences if they got their facts wrong. And I know there are exceptions or outliers to that, but in general, that was true. And now, you know, I can't remember. I watch sports on I'm holding it up now, my mobile device all the time. If I'm out with my kids doing a thing and they're running around and I've got a few moments, I would just watch a show or I'd catch up on my news or I would whatever on my device as opposed to waiting to get home. I can't even remember the last time I used my DVR, which used to be my, you know, holy grail of inventions was, I could watch without commercials. Now, I don't remember the last time I did that. In fact, we're cord cutters. We watch, I think we have Hulu TV or something like that. We have talking about disruption. From traditional industry.
Yeah, no, listen, creative destruction, those two words, creative destruction is just a law of the universe. You can't deny it. And, you know, things get created, things get destroyed. I mean, it's just, and, you know, government tries to get in there to prevent, you know, the destruction of legacy industries, but doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's just a joke. So you got to let create and technology makes that process go faster.
Yeah.
You know, technology advancement means more quickly things will get created and more quickly things will get destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the law of the universe, you know.
So as we think about this, what is it that we need to be on guard for? You know, how can this be in the name of Web 3.0 used to our disadvantage, or what are the consequences of, you know, technology not appropriately applied?
There's always a negative to everything, you know, I mean, but in general, I think it's a force for good, a big force for good. But, you know, people have to keep their eyes open. You know, they can't open an email when they get an email from a sheik in, you know, Qatar, who's saying, you know, we want to invest $1 million in your blah, blah,
right.
You know.
Right.
I get those emails all day long,
yeah.
You know, from some absurd organization around the world,
yeah.
That says, send me this, and, you know.
Yeah. Well, that seems like that's a Web 2.0 problem. I'm wondering, as we move into this idea of 3.0, you know, look, my kids are well-versed. They're probably the least likely to get phished. They're probably, my parents, the most likely to get phished. I need to check out this warranty thing that they're calling me about, or they're emailing me about, or how dare the Social Security Administration? Let me email them back and give them, you know, my correct number because they're getting it wrong. No, that's a scam. Mike, you know, back to that demographic that advertisers are looking for. My children are in that demographic. So I'm wondering, but those are Web 2.0 problems, it feels like. The phishing, the malware, that kind of clickbait. I'm wondering, as we look forward into 3.0, you know, what are the future problems that we need to, is it just going to be the same things repackaged, or I wonder what the emerging challenges are going to be?
Well, you know, bad actors are going to, always come up with schemes.
Yeah.
There's always going to be bad actors.
Yeah.
All the great technology in the world doesn't going to eliminate bad actors. And as we discussed before, they'll come up with new schemes. But, you know, people have to think for themselves. They have to be independent. And you know, what are the dangers of bad information getting out there? And, being repackaged, but propaganda has always been part of the world too. I mean, I don't know. Again, nothing replaces the individual from taking charge of their own life, making their own decision, and thinking for themselves.
Yeah.
None of the technology is going to replace that. And you can place that individual in history anywhere, and it's the same problem, right? Regardless of the technology, right?
Right. So as you look at you guys, how long ago did you launch your organization?
Well, we've been in the crypto world since 2017.
Okay. And how does somebody, I mean, one day, obviously you said to yourself, you've got experience in the world of tech. You're an early adopter as you realize, look, I really believe based upon this information that a couple things should come together. One, individuals, whether it's a few in the beginning growing to a majority, ultimately are going to want to do business in this way, in the crypto way, because it can hold value, it can do these things. I'm not, you know, I get whatever the freedom I get or ease of use I get as opposed to doing a fiat distribution. That's one. And two, people are going to want to take ownership of their own data. That's a growing trend as people, you know, you've got people like Tristan Harris and others that have formed organizations about algorithms and attention economy and all these other things where people are waking up to say, look, I want to own my data. They're not opposed to using data or sharing data or using these platforms, but they want to own their data. They want sovereignty over their data. Europe, of course, with GDPR, California has adapted a GDPR-like privacy stance. So as you guys are sitting around some number of years ago and said, we should get in this. What's the things that back your organization? How do you decide to do this one day, basically become a Wells Fargo or whoever? I want to get in this space because I believe we can serve our co-Americans, fellow human beings, by bringing these things together. What's that look like? How do you go about putting that together? Easy?
No, not easy. It's been very difficult, but it's been a great challenge. I mean, we're working in two very dynamic environments, the crypto world, and then the digital advertising world. And we're marrying the two of these things. Digital advertising is going through all kinds of changes. I mean, just massive changes. And it's just about how data, cookies, all of this is being handled. And all the amount of ad blockers and click fraud. And it's just an incredibly problem-ridden industry.
Right.
Really problem-ridden. And so we're trying to solve problems in digital advertising and create a currency to be the store of value, which advertisers can engage and reward users to opting in and sharing their data. So bringing these two things together, very difficult, but it's a great challenge. It's really exciting. I mean, everybody on our team is energized by we're giving the people the ability to capitalize on their assets, which they didn't even know they owned, their data, you know? And it's cool. It's very exciting, but very, very difficult, but exciting.
What's the biggest surprise so far where you thought, oh, this part will be easy? I mean, you obviously, you know, you've started businesses before, you've built them to success, you have experience running through that model early days. Man, how do I just make payroll? Not change the world. How do I just make payroll? How do I make this happen? How do we have a cohesive message? How do we get everybody on board? So you're experienced, I'm sure, with building businesses and doing that. What about this, putting these things together, knowing the challenges of getting people to adopt, be early adopters, industries that are going to resist? I'm sure you anticipated some of that. What's been the surprise, either positive or negative, that you're like, oof, maybe we underestimated this, or maybe we overestimated that, if I can persuade you to share anything?
Well, it's a very long list of challenges. You know, the biggest challenge is really seeking to be compliant globally. You know, issuing a cryptocurrency, every country has its own laws and regulations, and trying to be ultra compliant. You know, we bend over backwards to be compliant, but, you know, when there's a world of, there's a lack of clarity,
right?
You know, that makes it difficult. So that's been, you know, just an enormous amount of energy being globally compliant, you know, and that's been a huge challenge. But we're getting there, we're doing it. And, you know, I'm all about the government going after bad actors, and they should. That's their role. But that's been a big one. And then, you know, technology is a huge challenge. Getting the blockchain married with digital ads and having that all work to enable somebody to earn crypto when they don't have a wallet and making it super easy for them to open a wallet. Now you can get your ASK from Nike or Bank of America that's just offered you this ASK to opt in and share your data. Having that all work in a really delightful way is a huge challenge, but it's all great. I mean, it's all good, you know?
I could tell you're the CEO of a startup because they all seem to say that. They'll list these hard challenges and then they'll say, but it's all great. It's all good. It's almost like it's their mantra, whereas pretty much everybody else would be rubbing their temples saying, oh, I don't know if it's all great.
No, the bigger the challenge, the bigger the opportunity, the bigger the problem, the bigger the opportunity. And, you know, we really want to impact, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people's lives, you know, globally, that will enable them to start earning when they didn't get a penny. I mean, we get these notes from people from Vietnam and Pakistan and Nigeria. Thank God for ASK. It's enabled me to pay my bills and do things. And it's cool. It's great.
That is cool. I, you know, one of the things that that's why I kind of early in our conversation, at least as I look at, so I'm in my 50s, my kids are in their early 20s. For me, I have a high tolerance for, look, I know I got it. It's going to take me a few minutes to figure out, for example, how to set up a wallet. It's going to take me a few minutes, and if I don't know how to do it quickly, I'll just go get on the web while they mine my data about me, and I'll figure out how do I set up a wallet to do this, depending upon what device I'm using and what I'm trying to accomplish. And I don't mind. I'll take my time. My kids do not have that patience. If they can't figure it out in just a few minutes with a few swipes and whatever, they're not messing around with it until they're forced to mess around with it. It's just, which drives me to distraction as a parent, even an employer. You know, figure it out. Take your time. Don't be so impatient. But as you were describing some of the challenges, I could see that for at least some part of our population. If it's not easy and intuitive, they're just going to move on to something else. You just haven't captured their imagination.
And that's really the key for crypto really going mainstream is, you know, the buying, selling, obtaining, storing, transacting. It's a little wonky. It's definitely wonky. And you got to be patient with it. But I'm very confident there are hundreds of the smartest people in the world. I mean, hundreds of organizations working on how to make this thing super simple.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, big companies like I told you, MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Square, Fidelity, I mean, investments. I mean, there are just hundreds and hundreds of companies working to make it really easy. But it's not complicated.
Right.
If you go to permission.io, and I encourage your listeners to go to permission.io, you know, it's set up an account like you would any website or publisher, you know, put in a few things and you're in business. You got a crypto wallet and you're in business and you can start earning ASK and storing it. And it doesn't take much.
I'm going to go do it. I'm going to get it done in the next 24 hours. I'll send you a note if it wasn't easy, but I'm going to go set one up myself and check it out.
The one challenge is 2FA. Do you know what 2FA is?
No. What's 2FA?
Two-factor authentication.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning you got to have a Google Authenticator or Authy and say permission. You put it in your Google Authenticator. It gives you a number. You have to type that number in the website, and now you're in business.
Right. Now,
the only thing people get a little cuckoo on.
I don't have a Google Authenticator, but I've got a Microsoft Authenticator for my Microsoft account. You know, we've had to use them for years to do. Which is interesting. How I force my kids to use some of this stuff is: you want your Xbox Live renewed? You got to do it through the Microsoft Authenticator. And conversely, remember when you used to be able to go to the store and I don't know, Safeway or whatever it was out there in SoCal. Out here, it's Kroger and Publix. But I would go and I'd get my concert tickets from the local Ticketmaster kiosk or whatever there's the store. We can't do that anymore. And now it's all through the Ticketmaster or whoever's the ticket event things authenticator, essentially. Well, my kids forced me. They don't like me to – I hardly ever give them cash. It's all Venmo, Cash App, whatever it is on Bank of America. I forget what that is. But now we transact through these apps that I didn't want to have anything to do with a year or two ago. But because I've got a couple in college, I've got another post-college that, Caitlin, if you're listening to this, you need to get back in school. But, you know, we're exchanging electronic currency through our mobile devices, as opposed to giving each other cash. And my mechanic now, Venmo me. Don't give me cash. I don't even want to use Square. Just do this. And so many people that I know in industry either getting paid, if not crypto, certainly one of these apps, and crypto is just the next logical step. But they're also really interested in how do we get our products and services protected by some kind of a ledger program or a ledger blockchain, whatever, so that the value of the products we're creating is protected. I just feel like there's momentum, whether it's exactly what we've been talking about today or some variation of that, for the world to adopt these technologies. I'm curious to see where we go with it.
Yeah, well, blockchain is going to be great for, and you're seeing that, you know, the explosion in these NFTs, non-fungible tokens, these unique intellectual property for artists, musicians have really embraced NFTs. So take my song and I'm going to publish 100 versions of it,
right,
and let people bid on the market how high, you know, say, you know, for the original versions. And same with, you know, renderings, paintings, whatever. Right. And the market for NFTs is crazy. I mean, it's exploding, you know. Yeah. And so, and all forms of intellectual property can take the forms of NFTs. And you know, blockchain is great for that. Again, transactions, you know, doing transactions, recording transactions, verifying transactions. Mm-hmm. That's where it all comes down to.
What haven't we talked about that we should have, besides the fact that I'm getting a permission IO account set up here in just a few minutes?
Well, you know, in the permission context, there are hundreds of use cases for digital advertising. Mm. And we're trying to build out every use case, right? You know, email, open it, you know, spam. Well, spam's okay, but offer me something. Mm. You know, you want me to open an email? I don't even know who you are.
Right.
You know, ask me. Give me 100 ASK and I'll open your email. That seems like a legit kind of transaction, right?
Are we talking real money or are we talking about a few dollars over time? And the reason why I ask that is, again, I was talking to these folks that have this data mining stuff set up. And in the early days, you know, they were seeing double-digit checks, 20, 30 bucks. I don't remember if it's a week or a month. But it could add up to some significant money over time. Some money is better than no money for sure. But if people are listening to this conversation and they're asking themselves, am I getting paid a quarter a time or what do you think?
Okay, well, it's all contextual, right? Imagine you're shopping. I use the example life insurance.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
SelectQuote. These companies get $600 to $1,000 a lead.
That's
right.
Crazy.
So what if they share it with you? They say, "We'll give you $300."
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's,
you know,
a lot
if
of
you're
money.
Looking for life insurance or. You know what MasterCard pays for a new client? Like $4,000 or $5,000 to acquire a new customer. Experian and all these companies that are collecting all your credit data, they're getting several thousand dollars a lead. You know, so share that with the consumer.
Yeah.
You know, so it can mean a lot.
Yeah,
it all depends. It's context.
Yeah,
right. You know, if you're shopping for a car, that lead can be worth a heck of a lot, or insurance, you know. But if you're not, you know, it's all contextual.
Right.
But what you're looking for to buy, and who you are, and all of it, you know.
Well, I love the idea that I can own it, that the marketplace can then begin influencing. Look, at the end of the day, all these companies are trying to sell their products and services. That's what they're trying to do. So, what's the cost and the ease of use to capture, especially a younger audience, to get them to be a lifelong buyer of this thing? How do I make it easy and attractive for people to do that? For me, I want to own my data. I want to be able to opt in or opt out. And if I opt in, I want to be able to turn it into some value. I think this is part of the Web 3.0 story.
Yeah, no, there's real money. This is going to be real valuable for a lot of people. I mean, it's like, I'm a huge Marriott guy, right?
Right.
I earned, I don't know, probably 20, you know, I travel all the time. So I earned tons of points, right? And I got a Marriott credit card. I mean, it's probably worth 10 free night hotel room nights a year. That's a couple grand, $2,000 or $3,000 a year.
Yeah.
Because I'm loyal to Marriott and use their Marriott rewards programs.
Yeah.
It's real money. Same with the airlines. I mean, it's real money and real value. So think of it in that context.
I love it. I will. And I can't wait to see what you guys do. I really appreciate you coming on the show. And I am signing up for my permission account. I hope it's easy. If I struggle with this,
Let me know.
I'll let you know. I got the email of the CEO. We may just have to have some conversation.
Right. The only difficult thing is 2FA. You got to work through 2FA. And if you can handle that, you can start earning ASK. And
I can handle it. Won't be a problem.
Okay.
All right. Well, Charlie Silver, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to catching up next year and see how it's going for you guys.
All right, David, we'll keep an eye on us. And I really appreciate you having me on the show.
All right. Thank you. And if you've enjoyed the show, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. We'll see you next time on the QTS Experience.